I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week are outing programs. In particular, the Bay Area Outing Program, which in the early 20th century recruited over 1,000 indigenous girls and women from boarding schools in the United States to work as live-in domestics in the San Francisco Bay Area. This was part of the broader boarding school project in the United States, and these young girls and women were coercively taken from these schools and placed into these homes, which was part of the broader colonial boarding school project, but also put these individuals in an even greater place of vulnerability by being in the homes of individuals. But at the same time, they were able to forge social connections, navigating the relationships, while also finding place to assert their agency. And this is the subject of a new book by Caitlin Khalili, entitled Refusing Settler Domesticity, Native Women's Labor and Resistance in the Bay Area Outing Program, in which she studies the outing program and talks about the women themselves, how they were able to go through the program, survive the program, resist where they could, assert their agency, and how they navigated a system full of challenges. It really is an absolutely wonderful book, and I was thrilled that Caitlin made some time to talk to me. So very much enjoyed the discussion, and I think you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Caitlin Khalili. All right, and Caitlin Khalili joins me now. Katie, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Excited to talk to you today about refusing settler domesticity. So I think it would be good for us to really start at the starting point of the book, which is the Bay Area Outing Program. Yeah. And, you know, for a lot of folks, especially here in Canada, I will ask you about potential connections between Canada and the United States and general policies towards Indigenous peoples and First Nations. But for those people who might not be familiar with the outing program, what was the Bay Area Outing Program?
Yeah, so the Bay Area Outing Program was essentially a program that ran in the San Francisco Bay Area from roughly 1920 to about 1940. And for those 20 years, its whole goal was to essentially funnel Native women from U.S. Indian boarding schools to work as live-in domestic housemaids, houseworkers, throughout the Bay Area. And these were in very typically well-to-do communities and areas. So places like Piedmont, Oakland, San Francisco. And this program really was a precursor to Indian relocation, but was actually part of a national project of outing throughout the United States.
And particularly in this region, I would just, again, I'm not an expert by any means in Northern California and the experience of folks there, but I think a lot of people would associate Asian immigration and immigration from that country, specifically with the idea towards domestic work, as being one of the factors there. Is there a connection between any sort of change in policy towards Asian immigration and the creation of the outing program?
Yeah, well, you know, I think your instinct on that is really correct. Here in the Bay Area, there was a large presence of Japanese American domestic workers, as well as Chinese American domestic workers. In San Francisco, for instance, it was very popular to have a quote unquote Chinese houseboy or even a Chinese chef. And so that was very much, I think, the mainstay for a lot of domestic work in the Bay Area. And then once this program was created, it was specifically for Native women. Again, they were often funneling these girls from boarding schools, and even women in their older years would come back to the Bay Area to work through this outing program. So they're working alongside, again, like Japanese domestic workers, but the program itself isn't exactly influenced by sort of that pre-existing labor that was already occurring in the Bay Area.
So it's not like a response to diminishing numbers or a need in the market or a demand from wealthy individuals in the Bay Area who are saying, oh, there's not enough people to fulfill our needs, what we want. And so they're pushing for it, or is that happening as well?
Well, actually, that is happening. There is this notion that there is so much domestic work that's needed throughout the Bay Area. In fact, one of the earliest records I was able to find about the Bay Area Outing Program was in 1919. And it was just saying that, you know, Oakland housewives have like this sigh of relief because help is finally here. So absolutely, there were people who were well-to-do who had the means to hire these girls and really felt that this was something very necessary that they needed to include in their lives. And so, yes, it's a little bit of that as well. There really is this notion that there's a shortage and we need to fill it.
What is the main industry? Is it still gold money and prospecting money? Like where are these people getting their money? This is obviously pre the big tech era out there the Bay, the Silicon Valley. So what is funding this program?
Well, you know, what's really funding it, it's a federal program, right? This is literally coming, what we now call the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, was once called the OIA, the Office of Indian Affairs, down in the United States. And this program was officially an extension of boarding school policy. So the same kind of policies that were creating and establishing and maintaining boarding schools, they were also creating these outing programs. So this outing program is kind of interesting because it was independent. It was drawing girls from boarding schools. However, it's important to note that pretty much every single boarding school in the United States had its own outing program, where in the other direction, it was pushing students out and contracting out their student labor. So ultimately, you know, the people who are funding it, it's still a federal initiative, but the people, the homeowners, you know, the employers who are opening their doors to these Indian girls, these are pretty affluent people. Some of them are very, very wealthy. I mean, there's an example of an 11-bedroom mansion that one of the girls worked at in San Francisco. Beautiful home, by the way, to this day. And the kind of more commonplace, though, is like about a 4-bedroom. But Piedmont, California, I'm not really sure if it's on most people's radar, but it's right in the center of Oakland. It's technically separate. And Piedmont was a very exclusive kind of enclave. Kind of the most wealthiest people lived in that area. They were kind of the number one employers for this particular program. So these could be dentists, doctors, nurses, also lawyers, a lot of folks from UC Berkeley, also professors. Right. And it's important to note that San Francisco was really the hub, I think, for the Bay Area for a long period of time. But after the 1906 earthquake, many people fled to the East Bay and kind of built all new tracts of homes and really very exclusive neighborhoods and residences. So that's another kind of thing that's really funneling these girls into these particular areas, because there's, again, rich, wealthy people who are ready to kind of hire these young girls and bring them into their homes.
Which is, that's really interesting, kind of a very different from today, where it feels like, or at least the last, 30 years, where the wealth has really seemed to have shifted the other way from the Oakland, the east side of the Bay, to the west side of the Bay.
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating. I think now, you know, in San Francisco in 2025, I don't know if people could imagine this, but don't worry, there's still plenty of wealthy people there. there's billionaires in San Francisco.
So we mentioned the boarding school program. Of course, a lot of our listeners in Canada will be familiar, at least somewhat, with the residential school program in Canada. We also have day schools, or had day schools in Canada as well. For the United States, with these boarding schools, what was the overarching policy? And, you know, there's so much in the United States discussion about federal policy versus state policy. Right. But as it relates to the boarding schools, I imagine this fell to the federal government.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was officially a federal project. And kind of similar, as you were mentioning, in the United States, we had day schools as well. Some schools were faith-based, not all schools. In fact, I think the majority were non-faith-based institutions. The number of federal Indian boarding schools is, if we were kind of iffy, just if we're looking at the whole system, the NABS, the Native American Boarding School and Healing Commission, basically calculates that there's over 500 of these institutions, if we count day schools, faith-based schools, et cetera. So truly a huge network, right? And so these schools, they really start around the turn of the century. I think most people, at least in the United States, if folks know about boarding schools, they hear about Richard Henry Pratt. And Richard Henry Pratt was a man who kind of created this experiment with prisoners of war. He thought, oh, what if we, you know, cut their hair and put them in military garb and make them work for the local community? What if we teach them English and a little bit of math? What would happen? And at the time, his notion was kind of radical, that Native people could somehow be saved, if you will. Mm-hmm. And he's most famous for the phrase, you know, kill the Indian, save the man. there's a lot more to Pratt, actually. And he was truly didn't really love what boarding schools eventually did become. So he's a little bit more complex. But nonetheless, he created this system that started Carlisle Indian Boarding School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and would just move westward and create a whole new system. And he's actually the one who created the outing program. He really thought that students should meet and be with white people. He thought white contact was the supreme Americanizer. In his outing program, though, he was very careful about selecting homes. He also was very intentional about how students were treated. They were never meant to be treated, quote, like help. They were always meant to be treated like the family. But as boarding schools moved westward and these programs expanded, that notion of being treated like family, that was out the window. Nobody really cared about that anymore. And if we look at a lot of the Western-based schools, we see that labor exploitation, cheap labor, that was really the desire. So it really became a business agreement. And that's something that for sure occurred in the Bay Area outing program.
Right. I mean, that's interesting when you talk about the idea of people being treated like family. That's almost how like immersive exchange programs are advertised right today. It's like, go live with a family. You're like, and it's about like learning a language or whatever, right? That,
yes.
It seems like, yeah, that's really quite interesting. So when we get out to the Bay Area in particular, how many schools are participating in the region that you're looking at in the book? Like how many schools do we have?
Well, quite a few. Some of the main schools are like Chemawa in Oregon. We have also formerly known as Salem Indian School. We also have in Riverside, California, we have Sherman Indian School. Stewart, Nevada and Stewart Indian School is actually where this program kind of really was initiated first. A lot of the first girls coming to this program were Washoe and Paiute, which are a huge population at Stewart. But we had women also come as far as like from Haskell, which is a lot further from Kansas. So most women, I would say, were from this kind of Southwest Pacific Northwest region. But many did come even further distances because if a job was available and they were, you know, really interested in kind of exploring and seeing a new place, they would come to the Bay Area.
So there wasn't really an effort to keep people close to families, communities, anything like, was that part of the broader policy of essentially, as you say, taking the Indian out of these individuals is to take them out of their communities?
Yeah. I mean, literally that was the goal of outing. Like if we hear directly from Richard Henry Pratt, it was to take Native people out of their communities. Again, just to go experience other folks and, well, specifically white people. He wanted them to, you know, try to look like and emulate white people. But I think, you know, for some girls, getting to the Bay Area was kind of the closest to home that they could. That was also a job that would pay significantly higher than even wages in their rural communities. I was just saying the other day, I was like, you know, working as a housemaid, even if your wages are garnished and sent back to your boarding school, it was regular work that could happen. It wasn't necessarily seasonal. And not only that, but you were often getting much higher wages than, say, like Elko, Nevada. So it had these kind of pluses and minuses. Ultimately, it was the wages that brought girls to the Bay Area. And I think some really wanted to experience the city, you know?
So the book gets into some of the methods through which these girls were recruited and the some of the coercive methods, but you also talk about the wages and the opportunity that there was money involved in it. So what were some of the strategies that convinced some of these girls or convinced the girls to go and take these jobs? And how do you assess the coercive nature versus some potential actual financial opportunities that may not have been available elsewhere?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of these girls, we have to remember that Indian boarding schools are literally training them to be maids. So the ostensibly they're going to be housewives, but the majority of these women walked away and became housemaids because that's the kind of job. They were literally taught only, quote, domestic science. You know, that was it. So I think a lot of these girls saw this as the ultimate thing that was available to them in their lives. So like, might as well start now, let's start working. You know, it's interesting because there's the case of at least one young woman from Southern California in Riverside at Sherman Indian School. And she actually said, if your name was on a list, you were put into outing. So she didn't even talk about whether or not she had a choice. She really felt that she didn't have a choice, that she was forced into this. So in those kind of more internal school documents that are respective to that institution, I don't know. But a lot of girls would write the outing matron and just say like, hey, I'm coming to the Bay Area in May. I would love for it if you can, you know, I'd love for you to get me a job in the area, and try to list things that they'd like. And sometimes the matron would be accommodating. So if they said, I don't really want to take care of children, then they wouldn't, you know, put them in a home that would have them take care of children. But girls, I think eventually in the program, especially towards the 30s, which I would say is more of the peak of it, they came down with cousins and sisters. And the key thing here, though, is that they're live-in domestic house workers. So they're not really seeing each other. There's right. not a lot of community. But during this program, especially in the 30s, the one day off that girls had was Thursday. And so they would try to all meet together. And through that, they created an organization called the Four Winds Club and started to kind of organize in the Bay Area. But I think having that camaraderie, if even one day a week, was desirable. And you have to remember, a lot of these girls coming from boarding schools, are very, you know, highly surveilled spaces. And so even though you are literally moving from one highly surveilled space to another, I think there might have felt like some kind of freedom. And at boarding schools, these girls are also cooking and cleaning and, you know, making their uniforms and ironing and all of this in their respective boarding schools for free. So to get paid to do that would feel like a big difference, right? Like, oh, wait, now I have money. I can, you know, go to the movies, or I can buy new clothes. Like that would have been really desirable.
Right. And so I get that idea that, yeah, there's a bit more potential freedom, but you also, as you say, are still going into a heavily surveilled space. And were there any vetting of the families of any sort of level of protection, or was it literally you have money, you have a space, you'll take somebody? Like, was it that simple?
Yeah, you know, I hate to say it, but I think it's really the latter. I think it was just that we had the outing matrons who were kind of connected to these more wealthy families, especially also through the YWCA in Oakland. That was another kind of contributing factor. You know, I think that the assumption was that these were good homes that girls should be so lucky to go into. But in my own research, in, you know, delving into these archives, thousands of documents, there's really maybe a handful of site visits, if that. And it's usually if a girl has done something against the family, supposedly stolen something or whatever. So from what I can tell, no one's really doing house visits. No one's, you know, making sure this is a good fit. And no one's checking in on the girls. There's some situations where I found girls who were forced to sleep outside. Other instances where girls were forced to sleep with the infants, which obviously meant that they never slept and they were working around the clock. And I think that's the really important sort of aspect of this, is live and work is you're on the clock. It's just really demanding. There's no stop time. So even girls having one day off means, okay, they get a breather for 24 hours and then they're back at it. Right.
Right. And maybe not even for 24 hours if they're sleeping with the infants, right? Like
yes.
maybe 12 hours. Yes. Right. So, yeah. So within that environment, then what type of recourse, if any, did the girls have when they were mistreated, when there was abuse, when there were problems? What were there actually mechanisms through which they could officially go before? Because I do want to talk about resistance, but was there anything officially that they could do?
Officially, the best they could do would be to contact the matron, write to her, appeal to her, and say, you know, X, Y, or Z is happening. Can you help me out? So they often wrote to the matron if, like, their employer wasn't paying them and they wanted the matron to intervene, which to me would be her obvious job. She should be doing that. Yeah. She should make sure that these girls are being paid. But often I found that the matron was not always advocating for these girls. If they didn't like their placement, or if the owner refused to turn on the heat in their bedroom, these are things that they tried to appeal to the matron. These were not always successful, though.
What sort of stuff? Because the resistance part of this book is really fascinating, obviously a key component of it. What type of resistance could they, I'll say, get away with? Because I can't think of a better way to say it. But what sort of stuff could they do in their position?
Well, I think a lot of girls, if they were really fed up, they would just like go out and find some local folks to just like blow off some steam, maybe go to a bar, a dance hall, whatever it was. And some of these girls would basically be in very big trouble for doing that. But I think the matron also tried to, like, quote unquote, give give girls like a second chance. So, mm-hmm. and she'd often say things like, oh, they're just hanging out with the wrong people. So it wasn't that they themselves were like bad, but they were just being spoiled by other folks, and, you know, shouldn't be around those people. And girls would often sometimes refuse their employers. Some would just straight up leave. They'd say, I've packed my bags and I'm gone. And they would write to the matron sometimes even days later after they've left, just to say, oh, I left that place, just letting you know. You can send my remaining, you know, funds back to me here. And those letters I love the most, because we have to remember that, you know, to resist in something, this structure, right, it's really actually a big deal. They are very much surveilled by their employers, by the outing matron. They're forced into these like particular structures and roles. And they just are like, I've had it. I don't want to do this anymore. And I really love that. And so in the book, I try to really capture those stories. And I think it was kind of the thing that I think drew me so much to this project.
But in asserting that level of agency by leaving, how big of a risk is it for these girls, not only in the sense of, well, if you're far away from your community, you might have a little bit of money that you've made, but perhaps not enough to survive for that long. Yeah. Potentially there's repercussions if you can get in trouble through the program. How risky was it to take that leap and to leave a family?
I think it was very risky. Because you risk, one, you may never get a job in the Bay Area again, mm-hmm. possibly, if the matron was very mad at you. I think also a lot of these girls, I mean, yes, they would come by train and all that, but they often did not control their own funds. In fact, if we look at the entirety of the program, they didn't, unless they were much older. So let's say like a 19-year-old girl wants to run away and decides she wants to do that and leave these placements. She officially, her bank account is actually in the matron's name. So unless she squirreled away some funds in some way, shape, or form, like she may not even have money for a train ticket home, right? And so that could put her in a dangerous area. And the Bay Area, like just like any major city, there might be some vices or some not so great people that could prey on these young women. So I would say that that would be very risky. And if we look at the history of boarding school, like even runaways, like often girls were like most recognizable, easy to target. And that would be a problem.
Yeah, because I would imagine that as in any urban center, the opportunities for exploitation, yes. for individuals who might be vulnerable because of lack of money, not knowing people, whatever it is, like those risks would be very significant. And so it's almost in listening to you talk, like sometimes these girls are in like no-win situations.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have a situation of girls, they weren't even runaways at all. But they were actually abducted by somebody in the area. And thankfully, like the cops intervened and were able to separate them from this guy who was trying to take advantage of them. But they were arrested. So they were treated like criminals, even though this much older man is taking advantage of them. Right. So it also reminds me that in these spaces, Native women are, you know, criminalized at a different level. And so it's, again, that much more riskier to do these kinds of things.
And how important was the community that was built? You mentioned the Thursdays off.
Yeah.
In terms of the resistance side of it, do you have examples of, you know, they're sitting around and like, oh, maybe I can do this, or maybe I can do this, or, you know, obviously you let off steam sometimes, but are they, I don't want to necessarily say organizing, but let's say organizing and coming up with ways to, again, assert that agency, push back mm-hmm. against some of the ways that they're being surveilled through their employers.
Yeah, well, they are organizing through the Four Winds Club. So what's kind of interesting is in learning about the history of the Four Winds Club is kind of contested about when it starts, but at least one person says it starts in the 1920s. So if we say this starts in the 1920s early on, fairly early on into the program, some folks say that it started with one of the matrons and it was supposed to be like this safe space, this contained space where girls could organize. But through this organization, they started to kind of create community, which I think is something that was really important and vital to them and their livelihoods in the Bay Area. So they started to create dances and socials and Christmas parties and Halloween parties for like Native kids in the area. Thanksgiving things, feasts, socials, also like eventually date nights. So while this program was really just for Native women, once we get to just on the cusp of World War II, we start having, you know, Native men enlisted in the military coming into the Four Winds Club. So it actually grows and becomes this like sort of co-ed Native organization, one of the first Pan-Indian organizations in the entire San Francisco Bay Area. So it really grows into something I think very special, and something I show in the book. It very much connects to today's modern Bay Area Indian community.
And how much of that is not only the girls and then young women who are part of the outing program, how many people are staying active within that group, building that community once they are no longer in the program, when they're out of the boarding school system?
Oh, yeah.
Do we see that kind of generationally as the program moves on, that the women who started and they're early continue to be active and we're building this generational group?
Yeah, from what I can tell, a lot of the women, you know, over a period of time, again, this organization might have been around 20s, 30s, 40s, or was around 20s, 30s, 40s. As we start to see, you know, Native people coming for military service and even in higher education, going to UC Berkeley and other local universities in the Bay Area, we start to see, I don't know, many dozens, let's say at least 50 members. And then that grows exponentially as whole families come to the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a family space. So even when he was a young kid, my dad was involved in the Four Winds Club as like a little guy. So it's really something that had sustained the community. And later, a lot of those folks become involved with the Intertribal Friendship House, which starts in the 1950s. And that's a mainstay in the Bay Area Indian community today. So I would say a lot of that early influence from that organization is still part of kind of like our DNA in the Bay Area Indian community.
So that's really cool, that the idea of building community,
yeah,
despite circumstances that
exactly are,
yeah, yeah. And sort of the power of the group and power of humanity, of people being able to come together in those situations. Now, the book also situates this program within the broader and wider history of coerced labor in the region. Right. So I'm just wondering, I don't necessarily think it would be specific to the Bay Area, but because there's coercive labor everywhere, but what is it?
Oh yeah.
what is it about the Bay Area or that this tradition of coerced labor specifically, yeah, in the region, and how does this program fit in with that?
Yeah, well, I think when I was doing this history, obviously I'm talking about 1920s to 1940s, but it connected so clearly with me to different eras within California of Indian labor exploitation. And I thought it was really important to tell that story first, which is why it's really the first chapter in the book. It really orients this arc, if you will, of Indian labor exploitation throughout California. So I actually start with missionization, the arrival of the Spanish, and how even through those kinds of systems, Native women in particular and Native people were put to work. Like the reasons why these missions even exist to this day is because Native people built them. So that entire, you know, system was built on the backs of Native people. And it was one of the first institutions in California, as we know it today, that was really trying to also create a gender division of labor, that was really trying to put and force Native women into servitude. And so I saw that throughout this, you know, the Spanish period, and then, of course, into Mexican California, similar institutions occurred, especially during the rancho system. And so similarly, I was sort of seeing like, hey, we're California is built on Native labor, if we really look at this history. Right. And it's so very clear in the American period. Once, you know, California becomes part of the United States, we have this law, this policy, and it was actually created 4 months before U.S. statehood. So even before California is not even officially California as we know it. And it's called the 1850 Act for the Government and Protection of Indians. And that act in particular allowed Native children to be, quote unquote, indentured by specifically white families and individuals throughout California. And so through this law, basically Native children were put to work, to labor as domestics. And it's also very clear that there was a sexual element of this, that some Native girls, for instance, were indentured for other reasons. But when we look at this policy, it's so clear that it's very deeply embedded in the history of California. So for me, I saw this policy in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s of outing just in the Bay Area as deeply connected to that longer history.
Hmm. Is it curious that it's like, again, and I'm not an expert in the field, but it seems like a lot of the interactions between the federal government and indigenous leadership often infantilizes the leadership, but at the same time, like you're saying, they're putting children to work. So yes, they're kind of treating them as adults yes, in that sense. There seems to be a real disconnect in the policy that's being created, mm-hmm, towards these individuals. And obviously there's been resistance throughout history to these types of policies, mm-hmm. but is there something unique in the Bay Area that's happening that isn't necessarily something that is recreated elsewhere? Is like whether it's the geography or the nations that are there, or the communities that are built there. Is there something specific to this region where we're seeing resistance and forms of resistance compared to some of the broader trends that we see around the country?
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like there's something in the water out here in the Bay Area. There's got to be. Like, if we even just look at, like, you know, mid-20th century resistance, right, we can look to the Black Panther Party. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. We can look to the Black Panther Party. We can look to the occupation of Alcatraz. Like, there really is, I think, a strong, a strong sense of, like, justice and rightness and equality that is very central, I think, to a lot of like kind of Bay Area communities and just ideologies of like living and growing up here. You know, perhaps it is changing, but there's such a deep history of that in a sense, perhaps it is connected to this longer thread of resistance, you know, throughout these periods of time.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, again, from afar, San Francisco has the reputation, and the Bay Area in general, because certainly Oakland is included in this as well, has the reputation of being a place that pushes for justice in some forms, right? That is the reputation. Yeah. And certainly the individuals that you're talking about this book would fit in to that broader trend. And so it kind of fits with what the, again, from 3,000 miles away, what the reputation, what the city's or the region's reputation is. And so does that kind of jive with and fit in with obviously this story that you're telling, but also your experience as being someone out there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think also this book itself, I think, is a love letter to Native women, but I think it's also a love letter to the Bay Area because, mm-hmm. you know, my family came before relocation, so not at all on relocation, and we're involved in the Four Winds Club and all these organizations. And, I think there's just something to be said about, you know, a generation of Native people that really made the city their home and all the community centers that have really sustained generations, quite literally, up into this day. So I think it's really important. But, you know, I think what's really interesting, too, is as I was writing this book, especially in kind of the first in the intro, even I explore this idea of the Bay Area as being seen as like this liberal place, you know, this like was really even activist place and all that. And it is that in many senses for sure. But absolutely the liberal sense this time was like, we're going to help Indian women by hiring them. Right. They can, you know what I mean? They can cook and clean for me. And that's how I'm doing my part to save Native people, to solve the Indian problem. Right. So it's kind of this irony, but there's absolutely, especially in the Bay Area, speaking about what makes this, you know, particular project so interesting because of the Bay Area is there was quite a bit of this sort of like feminization of philanthropy. You had a lot of women who had a lot of resources and power, and they were trying to do what they could to help kind of the most interesting plight at the time, right? So it reminds me of, you know, women just trying to do well during that period of time in the confines of what was available to them as well.
Now, given the obvious caveat for this question of the surveillance and the risk and the sexualization and everything that happens to these women, does their place in the home as working in a domestic sphere, does that give them greater access potentially to forms of resistance or to seats of power? And that because of their direct access that they have and the, I don't want to say the sort of privileged place, but the access to privileged places potentially, does that give them more power, greater access to this resistance and just kind of give them, make them a stronger voice than perhaps some men who maybe are more directly marginalized? Even if I'm not saying that in the most eloquent way, I hope I'm being clear in sort of what I'm trying to get at. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think let's say like best case scenario, the family does actually treat this young girl in the best way possible or kind of like the family, or she's treated decently. She actually gets paid her wages and she has a pretty good experience. Then I think in that sense, like, she is living potentially a better life than her parents, quite literally. Like, she's not doing, it actually is manual labor though. We have to remember domestic work in the 20s, 30s and 40s was backpacking work. So it is manual labor, but she's able to get access to a kind of labor that is unavailable to say her father, for instance, who has to rely on seasonal work. So in a sense, it can be, let's say, a good job. And maybe she makes good connections with the either the employer or the matron. And those connections can afford her certain, not luxuries even, but those connections might afford her certain benefits.
The other thing, too, that I'm wondering about is, even in a situation where one of these girls or women are treated poorly, they also, do they not like know where all the skeletons are for this family? Does that not also give them some level of power over people who are treating them bad, or almost like a way to push for better treatment is when you know where everyone is buried, so to speak, you know?
I mean, yeah, we have to remember these women, these young women were working in these very intimate spaces, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe they do know, maybe they do have the dirt or something like that. But I think, you know, living and working in these homes, which were very fancy and just thousands of miles away from home, from their boarding school, right, from rural communities where they often came from. I mean, some of these employers really had fancy dinners, right? And they probably would have had all kinds of china and different kinds of very fancy things. They'd have a radio, right? Things that maybe were shared in like a boarding school kind of space. So this question actually reminds me of a letter I came across of a woman who basically was like, I'm done. I'm refusing to work for this woman. But she says something along the lines of, she writes one of the matrons and explains that this woman is having these fancy dinner parties and, you know, she's entertaining constantly every single week. And if she can, you know, do all of that, then she had better pay her maid at least $30 a month. So she really said, hey, if she's not going to pay my wage, I'm out of here. Okay. So actually living in that home and seeing all this wealth and abundance was a bit of a slap in the face for her, because she's like, I know you're spending all this money on these fancy parties. Why aren't you going to pay me a fair wage? You know?
Yeah. And a very reasonable question, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So as the program winds down and, you know, as you say, the book goes through the 1940s, is there a long-term, we talked about the organization before, but for the women themselves, like long-term ramifications, is that something that was traced, that you traced during the book? And, you know, how does this program affect them as people for the rest of their lives?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think for a lot of these women, let's say there are pluses and minuses, if you will, from the Bay Area Outing Program. As with, I don't know, most federal Indian policy, there's probably more minuses. But I think for some women, they fell in love with the Bay Area. I mean, a lot of these women actually did stay in the Bay Area and built their homes and their lives and their families in the Bay Area. So I think there's something to be said about tapping into that community that they themselves created. I think that's really a benefit. And I think a lot of women, the reality is this, again, was the kind of work that boarding schools were training them for. So outing meant they can get a wage for the things that they were already doing in school. And once they left outing, let's say they found their own job elsewhere, maybe they worked for a cannery briefly. For a lot of these women, it was the only experience they had was domestic work. So even if they got the opportunity to, say, work at a Kaiser shipyard during the war, that would be short-lived once all those men came home, right? And so they get this kind of like taste of other industries, other jobs where a matron isn't, you know, on your neck and just watching your every move. And then for a lot of these women, they would actually return back to domestic work. So it's kind of the unfortunate reality of if you train a generation of young women to be maids, you will find that that's the kind of work that's available to them.
Yeah, it's kind of hard, as you say, to get out of that when that's what your training is, and when socially that's what the expectation is on you, right? If the market sees you as someone who is going to work in a domestic space,
yes,
it's going to be difficult for you to find employment that's outside of a domestic space, even if you have the skills and ability, right?
Yeah, you truly can't. I think the one benefit, though, especially for these young women, for those who are able to get their children into public school in the Bay Area, this was not always the case. Oftentimes, they were encouraged to send their kids back into boarding schools where they came from. But if their children were able to get that public school education in the Bay Area, then no way, no how were they becoming housemates. Right. Most public schooling at that period of time was actually training young women to not be subservient to anybody else, right? You might be subservient to your husband. Those, I think, were the expectations, but it wasn't even to put you in the workforce. That wasn't really a thought at that period of time for typical public schooling.
So overall, I know this is a hard question, but the legacy of the program in general in the Bay Area, obviously, as you said with the last answer, like a mixed bag for the women themselves, but as a program writ large for the Bay Area, what type of legacy has it left in the region?
Well, I think what's interesting is this legacy has been hidden for so long. Most people that I talk to, even if they have a distant relative that was actually in the outing program, they are not aware of it. They're like, what? There was this thing? What do you mean? You know? And to be fair, even when I talk to a lot of folks who know the ins and outs of Indian boarding schools, the same cannot be said about outing programs. You know, I think outing programs are often overlooked, even in thinking about the newest federal investigations here in the United States that we did recently. They didn't touch outing programs whatsoever. So it's really an incomplete picture of the impact of these institutions. But I think for me, when I think about the legacy of the Bay Area Outing Program, I would focus on Native Women's Agency and their drive to create community and to foster a space where they felt at home in the Bay Area, where they felt like they belonged. Because again, I still feel like that's connected to the genealogy of the Bay Area Indian community today. And I do wish more people knew about the outing program. And again, this is just one among probably hundreds of outing programs throughout the United States. And it's just a roughly 20-year time period. So there's so much more that I think we need to know about this, you know, big extension of the federal Indian boarding school system.
Yeah. And within living memory too, right?
Like absolutely.
These programs and this one in particular, like the book covers an era where there's still living memory of this. So
yes.
It's not ancient history. It still has great relevance in today in the community. And as you say, not a lot of people know about it, which is why we would encourage everybody to go and check out the book. So again, yes. It is Refusing Settler Domesticity, Native Women's Labor and Resistance in the Bay Area Outing Program. If you want to check out the book or just keep up with everything you got going on, what's the best way for them to do it?
I think the best way is to, you can check out my website. I can spell my first and last name. It's a long one though. But you can find this book through the University of Washington Press. And if you use this code WASHOE, WASHOE, you can get a 40% discount. There is a different code that'll give you 40% off and free shipping. But unfortunately, I don't know, it may expire by the time this goes live. But folks can visit my personal website, CaitlinKiliiaa.com. I also have an Instagram, Dr.Kiliiaa. And I try to be out there with the social media so people can access me and invite me for book talks and all that fun stuff. And perhaps that's how you found me, Sean. So thank you so much for reaching out. So enthusiastic about this.
I absolutely, my pleasure. Really did enjoy it. We will link to all that down in the show notes below. So check it all out again. And certainly look up the book and take advantage of that promo code. Because we love promo codes. So again, Refusing Settler Domesticity, Native Women's Labor and Resistance in the Bay Area Outing Program. Caitlin Kiliiaa, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Sean. I appreciate it.
So there you have it, my chat with Caitlin Kiliiaa, and I thank her for her time. Again, the book, Refusing Settler Domesticity, Native Women's Labor and Resistance in the Bay Area Outing Program. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from Voice of America, an article from November 14, 2021 by Cecilia Hillary, entitled Indian Boarding Schools Outings, Apprenticeships or Indentured Servitude. And in this article, Cecilia goes through and talks about, in particular, the Carlisle Indian School and its outing program that was located in Bucks County in Pennsylvania. And the school, the Indian boarding school that was there. But she also gets into how the school had students as part of outing programs. And in this case, there were a lot of those children who were part of the outing program were sent to farms and what that meant for the students, as well as the farm itself and the business that existed. also gets into broader questions about what this meant, how it fit into the broader Indian boarding school project in the United States, questions of removing Indigenous children from their communities, the idea of assimilating them into the quote-unquote American culture, while also exploring questions of exploitation of students and, as we talked about with Caitlin, questions of agency and power within these relationships, within these structures. In this particular case, there was financial mismanagement that led to a scandal and ended the program and what that meant. It had nothing to do with necessarily the students themselves and the exploitation. These actual questions about whether this is ethical or proper to have these students work in this environment, but it was about just the management of the finances of it. So it really does speak to just the power of the colonial structures as another great example of these outing programs, which before I talked with Caitlin, I hadn't really heard of these before, and certainly a significant part of the Indian boarding school project in the United States. And here's yet another example of them. So today's historical headline of the week from Voice of America, Cecilia Hillary, on November 14, 2021, Indian boarding schools outings, apprenticeships, or indentured servitude. And with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Like, rate, comment, all that good stuff helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus all the great written material that is available on the website. And as always, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, whatsoldestnews@gmail.com. So with that, I will say thanks so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old Is News.